Welcome to Anthony Ploga Music. This is Eddie Ludema, the producer of the podcast. I'll be the show's MC while Tony is away from the mic, hiking the beautiful Pacific Rim Trail with his son Jason. In part two of Tony's conversation with Jock Ellis, they talk about his transition into jazz and rock and his move to San Francisco during the peak of the hippie movement. They then talk about his development as an improviser and the difference between playing licks and riding the crest of the wave. They then get into a fascinating discussion about two of the iconic band leaders that Jock played with, Don Ellis and Frank Zappa.
How did you learn to improvise? I mean, when did you start with that? Did you take lessons from somebody or just try and learn by yourself?
Well, what I tried to do is I tried to learn by myself at first, yes. I felt like, man, you know, if I can just conceptualize what I have to do, I've got all these chops, I can do it. Not realizing the real necessity of learning changes and stuff like that. And just to play them right, because I always had a good ear, so I could fake it pretty damn well. But I wish I had studied it more. I got little tips, you know. Gary would say, you're just doing what you're doing, it's great, man, don't worry about it. But you know, like, these are little tips, you know. He'd give me tips, and other people would give me tips as I went along. I found myself, as I said, I was in that guard band, and guys like Tom Scott, and Barone, and Paul Novros, another really fine musician. I was nervous to take solos like in outdoor places around with these guys who knew so much at 19 or 20, and I didn't. So a friend of mine who had been one of the drummers with Don Ellis' band said, hey, listen, man, up here in San Francisco, we've got our rock and roll band, which I'd seen, which I really liked, and said, and we'd like you to join us, and we've got a record deal. And so come on up and join the band. And I thought, well, you know, I'll be able to improvise with these guys because I'm not really scared of them. They're not carrying this pedigree of that many of my friends did, you know. John Morell and all these guys. They were pretty sophisticated jazz musicians. And in fact, all of them, their parents were jazz musicians. So they kind of came prepared to the school. So I got out of town. I thought that would help me learn something, and I don't know that it did. After about a year and a half up there, I thought, I don't like the scene up here too much. It's just too passive, which is not necessarily the scene for a lot of other great players who have been and come from there. And I came back here, and then as often happens when you return to a town or a player that arrives in a new town, suddenly you get a chance to go out and play with a bunch of people. They want to hear what you do, and I did well.
Can I ask you about San Francisco? Just go back
to
San Francisco,
sure.
Just for a minute. You were in San Francisco sort of at the height of the, what would you call it, hippie movement or anti-Vietnam War movement. It was like the late 60s, early 70s, I think.
Yep. Like 70, 71, yeah.
Yeah, and you were playing with rock bands then.
Uh-huh.
And I think you even played with Janis Joplin's band after she had passed.
I played with her band. She was gone. I played with the Sons of Champlin, Bill Champlin, who ended up being with Chicago for many years. He's another great musician. And I played on North Beach with some amazing musicians with Louis Gasca, another great trumpet player, and Hadley Calliman, and a guy named Tony Palmer, a fine drummer, and Richard Kermode, who had played with Janis.
So you came back to L.A. then, and you started getting better gigs? And by that time, did you feel like you could improvise better?
I could improvise slightly better.
Or with more confidence?
I could improvise better. I was more confident. I was scared for so many years. It took me a long time and a million gigs, a little breaking down of chords, a little, just a lot of playing to start getting the confidence I needed. So I wasn't like, I mean, it would be like I was playing the bolero before I took a big solo, you know, because I'd get scared, you know. Sometimes you're going to take the next solo after some recognized jazz great, and you just happen to be there, and you don't want to sound like an idiot. And I did enough times to force me to try to learn more, and rather than quit, you know, let's get this more together. And it's been a long time now. I mean, we're talking about, I've been playing 60 years, you know, so after a while, you better learn something.
So I have a question about improvising that I've thought about, because I'm not a jazzer and I'm not an improviser, but I would think that if you play like a standard tune and you have, some standard thing that you're going to do, that when you improvise, it would be really hard not to keep repeating yourself or to keep doing sort of formula sort of stuff. I mean, I know for myself as a composer, I really have to guard against that, just falling back and probably unsuccessfully a lot of the time, or some of the times at least. And I would think when you're in the moment, that would be even harder. That especially if you're in a situation where you feel a little bit of pressure, that you're not going to go out on a limb, that you're just going to play something that you can do.
Well, that's called playing licks, and it's something that you may have studied, or you think that, well, this is going to fit in there. And I'll say that everybody has some of them, and you may need them. You may need, I can't think of what I want to do here, and you throw something in that you know is going to work on the changes, and it's going to tie together and stuff like that. Improvising on my instrument is very much like improv acting. You need to be present where you are. You have to understand the concept of where you are. You want to know what you want to say. If you want to be extremely musical, you want it all to be part of the performance that's being given. Meaning, you don't need to come in like a screaming banshee to get attention and to do what you normally do when that is not what's called for. So you have to have taste and all that kind of stuff. Knowing the changes is going to be really important in so many situations, because even an idiot will understand that you made a mistake in the audience, or they're going to look at each other and go, "What's that noise? What the hell is going on there?" I had an interesting conversation with Steve Hufstetter. I think it was only like last week. He's a great trumpet player, real treasure, and we were talking about the very thing you were talking about, and he was saying, he brought up John Coltrane playing Giant Steps. And he said, if you listen to John Coltrane, he plays probably 10 choruses of Giant. If he plays 10 choruses of Giant Steps, those first few changes, he will repeat himself a few times just to establish himself of where he is. And I guarantee you, as he said, and this is the truth, and going to the crux of what we're talking about, the audience won't know it. But one of the main things for me always has been, and I'm sure you, and every one of the musicians that's listening to this, is you don't just play for the audience, you play for your peers in the band. And your peers are going to know you're playing licks. Your peers are going to know you're repeating yourself. Your peers are going to know you're taking the easy way. If it's all super musical, everybody's going to be happy. But so much of the time when people are improvising, it isn't necessarily super musical. It may be just kind of playing something that gets them off. You want to be able to, first of all, make the audience, you can feel it when you're on riding the crest of the wave of a good improvisation. You can feel the audience starting to gasp and breathe differently. It's a beautiful feeling. It's what I strive for, the guys in the band, you can kind of feel them and hear them maybe like getting excited about it, and the rhythm section will pick up. The rhythm section will suddenly want to support you more and all, and that's when you know you're doing it. And I think the most important thing, yeah, it's like say something. You want to really say something, whether that it requires dumping the chords and just playing what's in your mind. And you probably will never dump the chords if you're at that level already. You're gonna stick with them, but you're gonna take it out, as we would say. Or whether you're just going to stick to the chordal system, but that may end up with just a polite applause rather than a shriek of delight, We are playing for the audience, all of us. We're always playing for the audience. You have to, otherwise, I mean, you've got to play for yourself. The audience is going to like that. The audience is going to like it, especially if you're playing for the whole band. The whole band's getting off on it. The audience is going to like it, but maybe. Who
So
knows?
you talk about playing on the crest of the wave. How often does that happen?
More and more, the better I get.
Okay.
Yeah, more and more, the more and more. So that w rather than accidentally falling into something, I drive it into that place. one can fall back on what we were talking about, licks. There are things that people do that, whether it's circular breathing and suddenly playing a 32-bar phrase on a trumpet or whatever, that you know is going to bring down the house. But if you have to use that all the time, it's only going to work a couple of times, right? So you want to have a few things that you might be able to throw in if you're at a loss for ideas or it's been a tough night, you know. But the idea is to try to find where the wave is cresting and get in there and stay on it as long as you can.
Have you had times when you were playing where you felt like at the beginning, like either it wasn't inspired or somehow you didn't have ideas and somehow you worked your way into getting on the crest of the wave?
Yeah, as long as you have enough choruses to get through it. Sometimes another thing that happens is, especially if you're in a larger group setting, is that you may only have 8 or 16 bars to say what you want to say, which you have to be careful not to say, I'm going to say everything I know. Right? You still want to keep it musical. There have been times when I have played in the first few bars, I just wanted to cry and put my horn away and get off the stage. I don't want to play anymore right now. I can't do this. You know, I can't do it. You got to pull yourself through it. You got to try and make music out of what you've done. You may have to go in an entirely different direction. And if you're lucky, you'll come through with enough to satisfy your obligation as a soloist. Otherwise, it's just it can be a real depressing situation. And you know, you get a couple people who go, and you guys in the band don't say anything and don't look at you.
Has that sort of happened?
Yes. And I think it's probably happened to everybody. But it's like, absolutely, man. It happens less now. You know? I mean, I went to a rehearsal maybe a year ago where it was a big band rehearsal, and the guy writes fiendishly difficult charts, and the changes were just really difficult, and it was up-tempo and went by, and I sounded like shit as far as I was concerned on that whole thing, you know, and that wasn't long ago, and there was no riding a crest of a wave on that. I was in the washing machine. I'd wiped out. Uh-huh. Yeah. But you can't let them see you sweat.
Well, you've played with some pretty incredible musicians, so I'd like to get your thoughts on a couple of them, your experiences playing with them. So one was, of course, who you mentioned already, Don Ellis.
Yeah.
And Don Ellis, for people who don't know of Don Ellis, was very famous for having mixed meters and really, I think, incredibly complex mixed meters. Like somebody told me once that he had like 22 and a half over 8 or something like that.
Yeah, 33-16. Really? That's a Bulgarian tune. That's a Bulgarian tune. 19-4. Little things like
that. So how could you? You said that he said you're one of the best readers that he had. How can you sit down and read something like that? And the first rehearsal, would the band sound good or?
Well, you have to learn how to. Oh, probably not. We used to rehearse like crazy with that band, especially because it was mostly young guys, because they're the only guys he could get to rehearse all that much. The way that I would begin thinking of those things, and I'll talk about Don in a minute, but the way I would think about those things is, there's a word in Latin music called montuno, and it means it's a repeating phrase, and a montuno is kind of where he was going with these things. Like most of the time, in order to keep the band together, he might have a tune in 19-4, but the basic rhythm that goes on through the rhythm section for the whole thing would stay basically the same, so that you could kind of, if you were listening and had an idea, you kind of know where one is, which is going to be very important. And I would say that the kind of experience that you and I and a lot of people have gone through of reading stuff like old school Schut or people that Monteverdi that wrote before bar lines. If you've done that kind of thing, you'll be a little better with it, because really it is just count out where you got to go and don't even worry about where the bar lines are. Just keep going, keep the meter going in your head, you know? I don't know if anybody else thinks about multiple times in that respect. Some people like to subdivide them 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2. And others want to break it down like a Montuno, like I would. You've got to keep your brains on. You've got to keep your brains on. And once you start feeling it, you can feel it. Zappa was that way too, in a way. Like Zappa's stuff was just so unnecessarily difficult a lot of the time. And
We'll get to him in just a minute.
We'll get to him, yeah. Yeah.
He's not the person I want to ask you about.
Let me talk to you about Don for a minute, though. So Don...
Yes, please.
Don came from... he was a very religious family. I think his father was a pastor or something. And he had been playing in the military. He was in the service with Eddie Harris. Eddie Harris, great Eddie Harris, you know. If you don't know him, listen to some of his stuff. Freedom Jazz Dance is one of his. And very, very rhythmic stuff. So he started playing with Eddie, and then he met this guy named Harry Harrow, an Indian, pianist, and I think he played sitar. And so he formed the Hindustani Jazz Quartet. And they were playing all these bizarre times that were endemic to Indian music. So he expanded on that. He did some Latin stuff too. And it was kind of almost a combination of Indian music and Latin music. Sometimes he really hit it on the head. He wasn't, he didn't really swing. He kind of had played, people used to accuse him of playing Dixieland over that stuff.
Really?
Yeah. I listen to some of his stuff now, and I think some of it was really quite good and really inventive. I know we played the Village Gate, and Miles was out in the audience, sat there for the whole set. And the girl singer that was with us went up, and she was talking to him, and he said, "The only thing wrong with that band is Don Ellis."
Okay, tell me what that you
was.
Think.
That was Miles's impression, but you know, Miles was such a different player. Miles would play three notes and make them all count, and Don would just bounce everywhere, including with a quarter tone trumpet and a lot and echo plexes and stuff like that. You know, he was on an edge that way, trying to do something more rock and roll with his jazz thing too. We did some rock festivals and stuff like that. We did a famous one. Came on right after Ike and Tina Turner and right before Jimi Hendrix.
Oh, man. How did
and
that
and the people did. Well, not great, really. The Columbia Records threw us in there, and it was interesting and all, but, you know, they didn't want to hear that, you know.
Was he a perfectionist in his rehearsing?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, he had to be because the things would fall apart. I mean, it was just like you can't, with those strange time signatures. And there's a lot of his stuff on the internet, you know, that you can and see some of these tunes. The one that dear Milcho Leviev brought in, who became a very good friend of mine, he's passed on too. He's a Bulgarian man, very, very famous Bulgarian composer and great pianist, really amazing pianist, who could meld Beethoven, Liszt, and strange Bulgarian rhythms into a blues, you know, crazy, crazy genius, man. But once he came in and brought in some of his Bulgarian music to Don, Don had met him in Bulgaria, things really got interesting. But you really had to tie yourself down because it was crazy.
Could it be that you said he didn't swing very much, that maybe it didn't swing because it was so difficult that people had to concentrate so much on the rhythm?
I'm not saying the band didn't swing. I'm saying he didn't swing. Sometimes the band would swing the hell out of those things, you know? He is a player. I don't think anybody would ever accuse him of being a funky player or a swing player. You know, he had some good ideas, and sometimes he carried them out really well. Other times he just kind of run scales and bounce around a lot, you know, and I think he was trying to, Just in a way, what you and I were just talking about, licks that he had, that he was falling back on to make it work within these situations. But I shouldn't at all demean Don's creativity, because he was a very creative man and started a whole great thing, you know.
Yeah, he pretty much stood alone during his time.
Absolutely, absolutely. And he was nominated for a Grammy. The album I did was nominated for a Grammy. I don't think he ever won a Grammy. He might have won a Grammy, but it certainly was well respected. And yeah, Columbia Records, we had a Columbia deal, and we went around with them and did all kinds of, ended up backing up like Andy Williams and Claudine Longet, the one that killed him.
Longet, yeah. So Don Ellis backed up Andy Williams?
Not only did he back up Andy Williams, we ended up being the house band.
Moon River in 1904?
We ended up being the house band for the Soupy Sales Show.
Are you kidding?
Yeah. We ended up, we did a lot of stuff I think we actually were on the Andy Williams show for a minute. I think we did like several, you know, maybe even a season of the Andy Williams show, you know, as his backup band. I mean, we could play anything, so we didn't have to be 1904. I mean, it was a good band, and it was a well-rehearsed band, disciplined band. There were enough really good players in positions, so it didn't sound like a bunch of kids, or it didn't sound stiff, you know. Ralph Humphries, great drummer. It was the drummer and some great bass players and Jay Graydon on guitar. Anyway, yeah, that was Don.
Well, another figure who you played with, and I think we're friends with, was Frank Zappa.
Yes.
Quite different, I would assume, from Don Ellis. But I have the impression that his music was also quite difficult, and that maybe he was a perfectionist too in terms of rehearsing.
More of a perfectionist. In many ways, more difficult. Frank was not in the least warm and fuzzy around people for the most part, and was more dogmatic for the most part. You know, unless he really liked you and felt comfortable with what you were giving him as your idea, he basically just wanted to hear what his idea was. Pretty much of the way through it. Yeah, he's, you know, he spent a lot of time putting that stuff down to paper and stuff. He was an extremely egocentric guy. Again, humor is where he and I touched base, and it broke lots of walls between us. You know, we laughed a lot, so he thought it was amusing.
You were at his house, I think, a couple times, right?
Several times,
And wasn't he like a fan of Verez, I think?
Yes, absolutely.
And liked it. Yeah, tried to write in his style.
He liked Verez, and he decided that he could do all of that. Now, he was not coming from a place where he had studied, and I don't know about Edgar Verez, but my guess is that he had had plenty of classical study before he decided to take it out. Frank just took it out. And there's no saying he was a dilettante. Pretty much all of his time working on things that he wanted to work on. So he would sit there and play a lick on his guitar that was incredibly complicated and then write it out. He was one of the first guys that I know of that had not a synclavier, was it, that you could play your keyboard and have the notes come out, which is very common with music writing software now. But yeah, you know, so he could write his stuff but you know, it's just a lot of licks that were like a 12-tone modern composer kind of stuff, lots of dotted 30-second kind of things, you know, and very, very, I think I told you about the experience that I'd had with Ingolf Dahl, having to do a gig with him, and I had a big solo, and it was fiendish with dotted 30 seconds and rest and stuff. Were you on that gig? With the debut?
I don't...
With Ingolf Dahl conducting? My Don Green?
I played one concert with debut, which is the hardest trumpet solo I ever had to play in my life, on a piece called Aria Symphonica. And I remember for about 2 months I had nightmares about it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that was that band had a, you know, Donnie Green and Ronnie Rahm and all the cats that were in that band. It was a well trumpeted band. So yeah, so that's another. So, you know, Frank, I remember being in the studio with Frank and just being just me in the studio in the glass room and him on the other side with the engineer and him wanting to hear these incredibly difficult things. And you either produce or you don't, you know? Yeah. But I liked Frank a lot. I found him amusing. Not a warm and fuzzy guy.
To me, it seems like he's maybe the only or one of the only people who incorporated, I don't know if you would say avant-garde, but at least modern classical compositional techniques into rock music. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. And he was on, I think, on one of his first albums, he does, yes. Right? And he just stole it. Another one, he's got the guys playing the bolero. And he's written something else over it. It's like what we call sampling now. What else did he have in there that I can't think of? Think of other little licks out of a Rite of Spring, stuff like that. So he'd swipe stuff and not credit anybody with it.
Huh. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, and then finally, a person that you still play with quite a bit is Robbie Krieger.
Yeah.
Who my understanding is a jazz musician, but he's probably most well known for being the guitarist. And I don't know if he was the main songwriter for The Doors.
Yes, he was. Yeah.
He was? Okay. So he wrote a lot of their big hits,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, the music, and then the singer did the lyrics for
Jim Morrison.
Wow, Jim's name goes, yeah. But Robbie wrote Light My Fire and stuff like that. I always used to laugh that, and he's mentioned it too, it's like after he wrote that tune when he was probably 19 years old, he never needed to work again a day in his life.
Because
royalties and
he made so much money off of
that, you know. And when you think about a lot of the Doors stuff has been that song they wrote, "The End," that opens Apocalypse Now. So many movies, so many movies that were, you know, where you hear a Doors song in the background because it's period piece, you know, residuals. Every time it goes on the radio, you know. That kind of music is very valuable if you really nail it like that. And so, yeah, he plays really well. He's a very inventive musician, and he decided about after that band broke up. I met him about 73, I think, and the band the Doors was over, and we used to jam together. I used to play bass with him sometimes at his house, and we wrote. I've got credits on one of his tunes from his albums, and he started putting out these records that sort of like jazz records, basically, with a lot of really fine musicians, everyone from Jean-Luc Ponty to who else? Jeez, he had some. Oh, Milcho Leviev was on one of his records. Just Tommy Mars from Zappa. Sal Marquez, big influence to him. And Sal Marquez, big influence to me and great friend of mine, too. That's another amazing trumpet player, you know, who well-schooled, well-fine musician. And he was with Zappa for a long time. And really, those records that he's on with Frank, he makes a big splash on them.
Join Tony and Jock in the bonus room, where they talk about a fascinating aspect of his multifaceted career, doing voiceovers for commercials and cartoons. You have to check this one out. Jock was more than happy to give us some super fun examples of his voice chops. Thank you for joining us, and if you're enjoying the podcast, please feel free to subscribe on any of the podcast platforms, and be sure to spread the word.